Once upon a time, when Miss Ethel May Hinman was leading a cowboy outfit through the hills, she had a narrow escape from death. The regular trail was closed due to repairs being made on a highway which it traversed, and Miss Hinman was leading the riders through the forest. It was pitch dark. Her horse suddenly stopped. Believing that he was balking, Miss Hinman spurred him. His front feet went over the edge of a 75-foot cliff. The animal tried to regain his footing, but too late, and horse and rider went hurtling down. Miss Hinman was thrown free before the horse hit bottom, and thus was saved from almost sure death. But she kept riding the ranges and regarded this as her closest call. There was nothing in the cowboy's work that she couldn't do, butchering pigs, branding cattle, and everything. She had been riding since she was 6 years old. More on Miss Hinman tomorrow. I hope you've been listening the last couple of days. I've been telling about Ethel May Hinman of Springer. And when it came to swimming, she was equally as daring as she was pulling cowboy stunts. At the age of 8, she was diving from 75-foot embankments into mountain pools. Later, she developed the various fancy methods of diving and swimming and was acquainted with practically every known stroke and dive in use. After participating in every known bit of performance which required exceptional ability on the ranch and in the water, she sought other areas for excitement. She learned of a polo team that had been organized in Ardmore and immediately joined it. She became a star in this sport and was equal in efficiency as were her male companions. Despite her leaning toward men's work and sport, she was wholly feminine in her manner and nature. She loved to dance, sew, and participate in all the pleasures which were part of the life of any girl. Here's another story of the daring Ethel May Hinman. She heard of the possibility of diving from airplanes into water and wrote to a promoter for a contract. She had never been up in a plane. Promoter sent her a contract and she went to Byers, Oklahoma, where the stunt was to be staged. When she arrived there, the promoter hesitated. Her beauty and apparent tender physique caused him to fear her ability to make it. But he finally consented. Unlike males who had dropped from planes into water, she executed a perfect swan dive without difficulty. The force with which she hit the water caused her bathing cap and suit to tear. She swam for half a mile after she struck the water, waiting for a boatman to bring her a coat so that she could emerge. It is believed to have been the first time a woman ever successfully performed the feat. She performed the same feat again when she dove from a plane into City Lake near Ardmore. Tomorrow will be the last of my series of stories about this unique young woman. Ethel May Hinman was probably the most fearless girl in the Southwest, and perhaps in the entire country. But she was so modest, and to speak to her, you would never have known it. She lived with her family in an humble cottage in the town of Springer at the foothills of the Arbuckle Mountains. She did not perform her thrilling stunts merely for sport. It was not a daredevil attitude which caused her to risk her life. It was a case of necessity. Her parents were poor, and she aided in supporting the family. She had 5 sisters and 2 brothers. She found it so natural to do what the general public termed unnatural that she believed it was her logical work and did it without any unnecessary pomp or ceremony. She knew the mountains perhaps better than any other human. But if she was not at home or in the mountains, she was either playing polo, riding at a rodeo, diving from a plane, or at a dance. Quite an unusual young lady, wouldn't you agree? Bob Hutchins' Uncle Bob Faulkner lived on Oil Creek in the Chickasaw Nation. He told Uncle Bob his plan to become a lawman. He said, "Why don't you ride into the new town of Ardmore and talk to Bob Coggins, chief detective for the Santa Fe? They've nearly finished the Santa Fe track from Purcell to Gainesville across the Chickasaw Nation. I plan to take Sally in to watch the first train come into Ardmore. Nearly everyone will be there. There'll be federal officers there, too. You can bet on that. Tell Tom Coggins I said to help you. He knows me. He's a good man. Elated by this news, Bob Hutchins rode into Ardmore and hunted up Tom Coggins. He was pleased to see that Coggins was a friendly, kindly man. "Come with me, kid. I want to introduce you to a real marshal who's going to ride the first train from Gainesville into Ardmore with us." This would be Bob Hutchins' second meeting with Heck Thomas, and I'll tell you about that event tomorrow. Bob Hutchins met Heck Thomas for the second time in Ardmore, and he remembered Bob wanted to become a lawman and asked his age now. Bob said, "I'll be 16 this coming September, sir." Heck Thomas laughed and told Tom Coggins that this kid had already done and seen more than lots of men in a whole lifetime. Old John Hall took him to the Spur Ranch in West Texas before he was really 7. He gave him a .41 caliber Colt to cut his teeth on. I tried to tell him what a risky, poor-paying job being a lawman is, but it didn't discourage him. He's not figuring on getting rich, and he's seen men gut shot and gunned down before. I'm going to let him ride the train with us from Gainesville day after tomorrow, even if I get bawled out from the main office. He became a proud young officer by Tom Coggins' special appointment as he rode the first Santa Fe passenger train from Gainesville, Texas into Ardmore, Chickasaw Nation. It was 20 minutes after 12 noon on June the 28th, 1887, when the shouting, happy passengers unloaded onto the platform and greeted friends in the crowd gathered to meet them. It was the largest crowd the new little town of Ardmore had ever seen. As a young man, Bob Hutchins worked for Bill Washington. This is how he got the job. He had heard so many glowing tales about the Chickasaw Nation, he was positive he could push on up there from his parents' home in Paris, and 4 days later, he rode up to the old 700 ranch house. Bill Washington was sitting in the yard enjoying the cool breeze and sawing on an old fiddle. When Hutchins rode up, nobody rose to greet him, but they were aware of his presence, he knew. When he finished the tune, Bill Washington pushed his dirty gray hat on the back of his thick mop of dark hair, shrugged his broad shoulders and squinted up at Hutchins, and asked him where he was headed. "Looking for a job," Bob answered tersely. Bill asked him how he'd like a job with him peeling mavericks. Bob wanted to know what that was, exposing his ignorance. Washington snorted, then said, "Branding them. This here whole country is open range, clear past the Arbuckles." Bob said, "Why didn't you say so? I wasn't sure if you were talking about a cow crop or a peach crop." So he was hired for $20 a month in feed. That job turned out to be quite an experience. While Bob Hutchins was working for Bill Washington, he ranged all over the region. But in the mountains, it was some of the worst country to ride that he had ever seen. Sometimes he took his horses to Bywater to get them shod, sometimes to Dresden, and once over to a little place north along the Washita, which he had come across on the Whiskey Trail, known as Darty. Westward he explored the timbered mountains of the Arbuckles and found Henry House Creek beyond Honey Creek. Both streams had fine big shade trees along their banks that made the clear blue water look darker. He followed Honey Creek to a pleasant waterfall and swam in the cold, deep blue hole beneath. It was a fishing paradise, and Bob frequently changed his diet from deer, raccoon, and bear to fish. The falls on Honey Creek had already begun to be called Turner Falls after Mazeppa Turner, who lived nearby. He was part Indian. Every time Bob could, he rode over to take a swim in the blue hole, catch a fish or two, and talk with Mazeppa Turner. Once upon a time, Bob Hutchins took Jackie Akers to a square dance while he was in school in Whitesboro and met Belle Starr, who was pointed out to Bob as the outlaw woman from Indian Territory. She was not a beautiful woman, but he thought her rather attractive, with soft, dark eyes and long, jet-black hair. He danced with her and found her fascinating. She was more than a score of years older than he, but somehow as he danced and talked with her, she seemed gay and young. She said she was part Cherokee, and Bob himself was part Chickasaw. She was able to speak the languages of both tribes, whereas Bob had by then learned only a fair working knowledge of Chickasaw. When Belle learned that he planned to become a peace officer in the territory, she accepted this information with interest. Later, when he began riding posseman for Marshal Heck Thomas, Bob Hutchins met Belle Starr for the second time. More about that meeting tomorrow. The next few days, my information will be from Gunman's Territory, the interesting book by Elmer Leroy Baker. Belle Starr and her husband, Jim July Starr, were in Fort Smith for one of their many cases in federal court. Belle was enjoying herself by shopping in town. She remembered Bob Hutchins and that he had played the fiddle for some of the dances. She told him, "Heck Thomas is a good officer. I hope you become as good as he is." Bob realized that Belle's attractiveness was not so much caused by her good looks, but by her charm and the elegant way she dressed. She was wise enough to buy clothes that would accent her best points. Black and white were her favorite colors, and she wore them often. She rarely dressed in a man's clothes. Even at home, she wore feminine clothes and rode a horse, side saddle. She could ride this way better than most men could ride astride. Hutchins had never met Sam Starr, Belle's prior husband. He had been killed in a gunfight with a Cherokee Indian policeman named Frank West. She married Jim July in a Cherokee tribal ceremony a few months later, even though she was 14 years older than the handsome young Indian. Belle had made him take the name of Starr as a part of their marriage agreement. Belle Starr was dead, shot in the back with buckshot. Edgar Watson was in the Fort Smith jail for her killing. He had been arrested at Belle's funeral by her husband, Jim July Starr, who was then a posseman. Watson told Hutchins he didn't kill Belle Starr and that he had indeed been framed by Jim Starr. Hutchins investigated this thoroughly, and when he knew where Jim July Starr was, he went after him. When they came to the showdown, Starr was shot and Bob Hutchins took him to Ardmore, where Dr. Bogey and Dr. Booth examined him and found him to be in very critical condition. They were not prepared to perform an operation as delicate as he needed in Ardmore. He was taken to the prison hospital in Fort Smith. He sent for Belle's daughter, Pearl, and told her he had an important secret for Bob Hutchins alone to hear. "If I can't tell it to him," he groaned, "I'll take it with me to the grave." A telegram was sent to Ardmore, but Hutchins was out of town and received word by another telegram that Jim July Starr had died that morning, January the 26th, 1890. True to his word, Jim Starr carried his secret with him to the grave. Bob Hutchins and Louisa Ethel Price met at a picnic at Lone Grove, Pickens County of the Chickasaw Nation. They found each other's company enjoyable as they sipped lemonade together and watched the horse races, foot races, horseshoe pitching, wrestling, and other sports. In the evening, when the picnic broke up, Bob walked with Ethel to Sweet Price's wagon. He asked if he could call on her at home the next time he came back to Lone Grove, and she was happy about that idea. She was the Prices' foster daughter. They didn't see each other often because Bob rarely got back to Lone Grove more than twice a year. They corresponded because the mail service was much more frequent. She knew he was definitely set on the law as his career. Ethel told him lightly, "Just get me a couple of six-shooters and I'll be a Belle Starr on the side of the law and ride with you after the meanest ones. I'll tell you about their wedding tomorrow." Finally, after 3 years courting, Bob Hutchins drove to Lone Grove in a covered wagon to carry away his bride. They had planned an elopement because neither of them wanted any fanfare about the event. But at Sweet Price's gate, the young deputy marshal ran into unexpected trouble. Sweet Price bluntly informed Bob, "You'll not carry her away from here like a thief and a scoundrel." Hutchins had met angry men before and said, "Ethel and I are going to get married, Sweet. No man can stand in our way and live." Ethel asked, "Cousin Sweet, are you against this marriage?" "No," he admitted. "He's courted you like a gentleman, and I intend for him to marry you like one. How about a barbecue and shindig wedding?" Bob found that he enjoyed immensely Sweet Price's well-laid plans and enthusiasm. No knight or lord of the Middle Ages, he thought, ever attached so much importance and goodwill to the come-one-come-all wedding, barbecue, and dance he held for the happy union.